Welcome to the Australian Catholic Historical Society podcast. At the Society's September 2022 meeting, Dr. John Luttrell, a Marist brother, presented a talk entitled Champagne Marists in Australia, 1872 to 2022. His slides accompany this talk at the ACHS website. If you're watching as well as listening, this sound is the cue to advance to the next slide. In the course of welcoming Dr. Luttrell, the Society's president, Dr. John Carmody, said,
"This colony was almost colonised and discovered by the French. The Brits got in first, for better or worse. So we almost were a Francophone country with all its cultural and philosophical and religious differences from what we consider the mother country now. When the Marists arrived in 1872, it was at the height of one of the most politically fraught times in the 19th century, when religion was under, and religious education in particular, was under discussion. So if there'd been more Marists able to come, that might have reinforced the French tradition in Australia, but that wasn't to be. Those two things to me are two of the great what-ifs of Australian history. What if there'd been, if the French had got here just before the English, and what if the Marists, great though their influence was, had a much wider social influence and Frenchified this country. But it was very Irish when they arrived, and it remained Irish to this day.
Now, here is Dr. Luttrell.
I'm talking about the Marist brothers in Australia, 1872 to 2022. Before you entered the hall today, you might have noticed on the left hand of the door the bronze bust of a French Marist brother, Brother Ludovic Labareus. This was commissioned by St. Patrick's Parish and unveiled on the 8th of April this year. And Ludovic was the leader of four Marist brothers who arrived in Sydney on the 21st of February 1872 and began the first Marist Brothers school in Australia across the road on April the 8th. Now, the Marist Brothers were an expanding congregation at the time. They'd been founded in France in the early 19th century by Father Marcelin Champagne. And after 1872, more brothers came to Australia from Europe, and also young men joined the congregation in Sydney. Within 30 years, there were communities of Marist brothers in most states of Australia and in neighbouring islands of the South Pacific. And the Roman congregation of Propaganda Fide called that huge region Oceania. Now this year, the Marist brothers and their colleagues and friends are commemorating 150 years of their educational mission in Australia. And one event has been the publication of a new history called Sub Tuum Praesidium. This is a joint effort of four writers and one of those myself. When Jack Carmody became aware of the sesquicentenary and of the forthcoming book, he invited me to speak to you today. Now, you might have come to this talk with various impressions and questions. I think many of you would have been educated by nuns or priests or brothers, probably most of you. And in my case, it was 7 years with the Josephite sisters and 5 years with the Marist brothers. You'd have personal memories of your own schooling, maybe nostalgia, maybe mixed feelings. At the same time, you'd be aware that there's been many changes occurring in religious orders and in schools in our lifetime. One of the four writers of that history, Brother Julian Casey, reflected on his own lifetime. And I quote, "In the 1950s, brothers identified themselves with establishing Catholic schools, operating schools, and teaching in them. They lived in small, dispersed communities and found an easy identity in a group belonging and in conforming to the behaviour patterns which were often a part of a somewhat enclosed subculture. But 60 years later, brothers were now living in a totally different subculture. Their communities had declined from focused, hard-working and cohesive religious communities to scattered groups of brothers with an average age of 77. Although most were active in some ministry, only a few had direct participation in the schools. And Julian then asks, how did these changes come about in my lifetime? Now, his question, I think, could be asked about many religious congregations in Australia and in what we would call the Western world. So a history of the Morris brothers in Australia can be something of a case study of the fortunes of religious congregations in Australia and beyond. It also needs to be situated within the context of changes in society and the church over those 150 years. You may be wondering how such changes have occurred and also about the future of religious congregations in Australia. So bearing in mind such questions and impressions and the broader social and religious change, I'll now look at the evolving story of the Morris brothers in Australia since 1872. The first community of brothers, a French director, two Irishmen and a Scot, were missionaries sent by their superior general to start a Morris school in Sydney. Why here at St Patrick's? The request for Morris brothers began with the parish priest at St Patrick's at the time, Archdeacon John McEncrow. But McEncrow died in 1868 and the parish was then entrusted to the Morris Fathers, a religious order which was closely related to the Morris Brothers. So it was logical for the brothers to start here in a Morris parish. And at this point I should note also that there were already some individual Morris Brothers in Oceania before 1872. But they'd come as assistants to the Morris Fathers in their various mission territories in Oceania. And one of them, Brother Marie Nitzier de Lorme, was a catechist with St. Peter Chanel when he was killed in the island of Fortuna, I think about 1840, I just forget the year. So the four brothers who came to St. Patrick's were not the first Morris brothers in Oceania, but they were the first to come as a specific Morris brothers community in Australia. Now the beginnings in the rocks, were difficult. The area was Irish working class. The boys were a very mixed group. Still, about 200 enrolled in April and eventually settled into school. The brothers themselves had to win acceptance from the families and clergy, including the new coadjutor Archbishop Roger Bede Vaughan. Now, Ludovic seems to have been an enterprising leader, and he gained the support of the parish. After this, more brothers came from Europe, and in 1875, just 3 years later, the French superiors agreed to open two more schools in Sydney, at St. Benedict's Broadway and at Parramatta, 1875. Probably from the point of view of the Morris superiors in France, this venture in Sydney was somewhat experimental. Not a grand plan to have a huge Morris network in Australia. Sydney's just one town in the distant Pacific. And they referred to this, as we said, as Oceania, And they're already answering calls for brothers from other places like New Zealand, New Caledonia, Samoa, Fiji. So the small community at Sydney in the Rocks in 1872 was just one of those responses. Now, given there were calls to Oceania from various places, the French Superior General in 1876 sent out an Irish brother called John Delay as overall superior or leader of the Morris brothers in the region. And he had the informal title of Provincial of Oceania. And almost immediately they commissioned him to open a school in Wellington, New Zealand. And then over the next 30 years, further schools are opened in Australia, New Zealand, Samoa, Fiji, at the request of the local areas. So that's the area that we're talking about. And when John Delay comes in 1876, we have one school in Sydney, and later in the year he opens one in Wellington. But there are already some, I think there had been a short-lived group in Samoa, and there were some, I think, in New Caledonia, but sent separately. So he has a very small province at this time. So this is John Delay in his old age. And you can see that he has a long period as provincial. So he would lead the Australian mission for most years until 1900. After 1900, he became a more regional leader based in France. So I think John Delay could also well have a bust outside with Ludovic. They were both very important. Now, how were they able to staff this growing number of schools? Well, brothers are sent from Europe, and they're mostly French and Irish. But the significant factor was that the Australian and New Zealand youth were prepared to join the congregation. And the superiors had asked Brother Ludovic to look for local recruits. So in 1873, a year later, two young Australian men applied to join Ludovic's community at St. Patrick's. And very quickly, he had set up what was called a formal novitiate. And soon there were annual groups joining the novitiate, and they had their own base and house at Hunter's Hill. And by 1900, a good number had joined, and there were 163 professed Morris brothers in Oceania, still ultimately led from France, but now they've got a promising majority of Australian and New Zealand members by 1900. So, numbers have grown across Oceania, and there's a need now for structures and organisation. So I need to get a bit boring here and talk about some of the main structures just that operated. And that they continue to the present day, by the way. In the first 80 years from 1817, the Morris congregation had been centrally controlled by the Superior General in France. John Delay, although he's called Provincial of Oceania, was really just his delegate. However, in 1903, the first constitutions of the Morris brothers were approved by the Vatican, and these provided for the creation of official provinces, each under a provincial who had more local authority and autonomy. So the region of Oceania now became called the official province of Australia. And its first provincial was Australian-born. His name was Brother Stanislaus Healy. Born in Maitland and christened Richard, he'd been one of Ludovic's first novices. Cultured and artistic, Stanislaus would also have terms as headmaster of various schools and a term as master of novices. He died in 1917. For brothers in the new Commonwealth of Australia, 1901, afterwards, there's now a sense of coming of age in the Institute. The numbers are increasing, and by 1916 they had 210 brothers in 38 communities spread across four states of Australia and Oceania, and particularly New Zealand. As it increased, the Oceania region was split in 1917 to form the separate province of New Zealand. So thereafter, the province of Australia was restricted to the geographical area of Australia. So leaders wouldn't have now to deal with the great distances across Oceania, the various islands. So that's after we've done 50 years now, pretty much, and you can see the growth. If you note, the new province of Australia is just Australia itself. And you notice that all these schools have already been formed. That's just Sydney, and now you've got Maitland and so on. Victoria, Adelaide, and even New Norcia. The orange ones are the new province of New Zealand, which has been split off. So even New Zealand has quite a lot of schools as well. So two provinces, that's that quite rapid growth. Now, the growth brought some potentially problematic consequences. The brothers are much in demand because parishes couldn't afford to pay lay teachers. There's no government funding at the time. Those lay teachers were only employed in the schools if no brothers were available. And they were almost universally male and would never be in leadership. And a second consequence of the demand for brothers was that teacher training was rather minimal, very minimal, until the 1930s, because brothers were just sent straight into teaching to fill gaps and so on. In the 1930s, they started to have a year of training, but often they would be withdrawn because there was a gap in one of those many schools. And so it was that was the way it was. Nevertheless, they were still highly regarded, and mainly because this was a time of the high status of religious in a very hierarchical church. And I remember seeing one quote where Archbishop Kelly here in Sydney referred to them as God-given teachers. So that's status there. Get to 1947, we've got about 340 brothers across five states. Again, they divided up the province of Australia, this time into the province of Melbourne and the province of Sydney. The province of Melbourne contained communities in Victoria, South Australia, West Australia, and southern New South Wales. So roughly this area across there became called the province of Melbourne. The rest was the province of Sydney, Queensland, and all those Sydney schools. And each province grew in brothers, numbers, and new schools, all at a time with no government money. So there were a lot of challenges. And those two provinces would continue until very recently, 2012. Okay, the life of the brothers. Pretty uniform. they'd probably go to a age of 12, 13, 14, they'd go to a Morris Junior 8 as secondary schoolboys. Then they might go into the novitiate, or they would go into the novitiate if they wanted to continue, and then probably for the rest of their life, teaching in schools, rest of their career. One example is William Reedy, joined from Camden. At the time of Brother Ludovic, he became a novice, and he spent 70 years as a brother teaching primary classes, especially at Cogra and Maitland. A simple lifestyle, and often inadequate materially. Minimal government support, and they really depended on the Catholic community for finance and moral support. And I think the Catholic community at that stage really was united in supporting Catholic education and made a lot of sacrifices to support the brothers and their schools. It gives a sense of the growth. This is just one group. You can see the veterans and the wise ones at the front row, the younger ones at the back. If they don't have a cross, they're in their first few years. Example of typical life. Might even be someone here in that classroom, I don't know. Okay. Now, we're talking period now up to the 1950s or so. And what you'd say, I think you could realise, is there's a sense of progress and confidence and achievement in all of that. However, from the 1960s, there are two developments which I think shook this positive mood, if you like, or environment. And one was the theological revolution in the church, which is most strongly driven by the Second Vatican Council, because that council emphasised the sense of the church not so much as a hierarchy, but more as a community where all Catholics, Christ's faithful, were equal and had the same dignity. Now, there were lots of implications from that. The second factor was the welcome return of government funding in private schools after so many decades where they had to battle for funds. Now, both those developments are blessings, but paradoxically, they also were challenges for Morris Brothers. More lay teachers could now be afforded, and the brothers now welcomed women to their staffs, and in Vatican II thinking, lay teachers also had a mission as Christian educators. So, were brothers needed in Catholic schools? Could one of Christ's lay faithful be a principal in a Catholic school? Quite a change of a school staff by 1970. So the new context affected recruitment to the Institute. Many brothers decided to leave the congregation, and the number of recruits in Australia has declined to a trickle in recent times. The number of professed brothers in Australia dropped from 600, roughly, in 1970 to 250 in 2011, and 2021, last year, 173 Australian brothers. Average age, as I said before, in the 70s. Few of those closely involved in schools. And then to these challenges since the 1960s, we must add the recent revelations of sexual abuse of children by brothers and others in Marist institutions. Now, this came to public awareness in the 1990s and has culminated in the hearings and report of the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sexual Abuse, which was held 2013 to 2017. The Commission investigated the period from 1950 to 2010, and its findings in regard to the Morris brothers were devastating. Complaints of abuse to either civil authorities or Morris brothers' authorities were made concerning what the Commission called a weighted 20% of brothers. They had another term called unweighted, which was 14%. And that was especially all in the period 1950 to 1980. They also said that Morris leaders had not kept adequate records of complaints and had allowed alleged abusers to remain in positions of access to children. So that was devastating, that report. Now, behind all of that probably was the lack of understanding of the tragic impact of abuse on victims. And so impact statements were offered by victims to the Royal Commission and also in redress meetings with the congregation, and that has brought home very clearly the lifelong harm of that abuse. What have been the findings, or what have the findings meant for the congregation and its mission? For most brothers and their lay colleagues, there was a drip after drip revelation of offenders within their ranks, as individual brothers were withdrawn from schools, court cases occurred, and some brothers were sent to prison. And media attention reinforced the gravity of the situation. The current provincial, Peter Carroll, in 2018, reported a spectrum of early feeling among the brothers. He said, fear about working with children, fear of false allegations, a profound sense of betrayal and of shame. They feel they've been collectively branded. They feel caught between the need to be just and compassionate to survivors and complainants and their relationship with offenders. They struggle with the notion of forgiveness. Learning from and responding to these revelations have been a preoccupation of leaders and brothers for the last 30 years. And there's been a variety of responses. Redress, compensation and support for survivors. Official apologies to victims. Development of protocols for the safeguarding of minors. Regular information and workshops on child safety for the brothers and their colleagues. Supervision for brothers who have offended. Now, all of this is in collaboration with government and church developing practices. Provincial Peter Carroll had this further comment to make. Can we heal the harm and hurt? And if so, how? There are no glib answers. Only deliberate, positive action will convince those who can be convinced that a cultural change has taken place. A more significant response is to go back to the very basics of our vocation, to be men of communion, service and prayer. In a word, to be brother. In the recent history, chapter 33 is written by Brother Peter Rodney, and he's entitled it Out of Darkness, and it's all about that crisis. So if you have the book, I commend chapter 33. My narrative then of the last 50 years has portrayed a shrinking, scarred, an ageing congregation with a doubtful future. Now, these negatives are real, but it's a simplistic and partial picture, Now, I'd like to turn to aspects of transformation of the Marist Mission in Australia, which allow for a more positive future. First thing, has that shrinking number undermined the Marist Mission of Education? Now, it's really hard to see this in the overall picture of Marist schools and welfare institutions. The Marist schools have flourished, and professional lay staff gradually replaced the brothers in teaching and eventually in leadership in the schools. The brothers came to accept these changes, hesitantly at first, but then they welcomed a lay co-responsibility and they fostered lay spirituality. So I'd like to expand on this by pointing to six spheres of activity where the mission of the Marist Brothers in Australia continues to flourish and even expand. So as the brothers became fewer in the schools and lay teachers took responsibility for leadership and teaching, there were questions on whether the schools would stay Marist. Would they keep that connectedness and identity? In 2002, an association of Marist schools was formed, and last year this was legally incorporated under the title of Marist Schools Australia. To date, 56 schools have chosen to affiliate with MSA. You can see the number of dioceses, and it's a little bit faint, the black print, but each line represents one of those 56 schools. Now, that's not just Australia. That also has Papua New Guinea, Solomon Islands, Vanuatu. But they're all under the supervision of the Marist Brothers in Australia. So that point I'm making is that do Marist schools die out as the brothers have declined in numbers? They certainly haven't there. So Marist Schools Australia, the company, if you like, or the leadership, provides many services to all these schools. Formation of staff, administrative and legal help, teaching resources. 12 of them are Marist owned, and the Marist brothers have direct governance responsibility for them. They appoint the senior staff, they conduct performance reviews. So my impression as an interested observer is that the schools are just as Marist as they ever were, and that teachers, parents and 50,000 plus pupils value having Marist traditions and identity. The second aspect is that there's been programs for students who wish to go further in their faith and Christian service. So they run youth retreats, youth groups, immersion experiences, and brothers and lay teachers have facilitated them. That's now organised under a group of leaders called Marist Youth Ministry. They have a national lay coordinator, and they've got regional teams in Sydney, Melbourne and Brisbane. Another area of Marist ministry which has flourished under lay care is that of social welfare. That began really in 1896 when the brothers took over or set up St Vincent's Boys' Home, Westmead. That was an institutional model, and it was abandoned in the 1980s, 100 years later, and the brothers arranged for the boys to live in community homes. In 1994, the Marist brothers established a new legal identity called Marist Youth Care to have responsibility for such boys and also for the many lay staff and the volunteers that looked after them. The name became modernised in 2016 to the name Marist 180. In other words, turn your life around 180 degrees. By 2020, Marist 180 was supporting 250 young people in several states, had a staff of 500, all lay, a lay chief executive, Peter Monaghan. Still, it is a responsibility of the province, Murray's Brothers province of Australia. That's just an example of Murray's 180. They sponsored this, or they arranged with the government for this home for homeless youth in Toongabie. And that's the opening day. They'd be staff and friends from all over, but it's just a sort of sense that in 1896, those five homeless boys would be at the Westmead Orphanage. Now, this notion of the separate homes and things like that is the model. Another development has been the regional outreach of the Murray's Australian province since the 1960s. Australian Brothers have developed mission schools in the Solomon Islands, Papua New Guinea and Pakistan. So as an example, in the 1990s, Brother Terence Heinrich developed a boarding day school in Cambodia for needy and disabled young people who were, if you like, the survivors of the Pol Pot families, the ones, you know, you probably remember the Pol Pot regime in Cambodia. So lots of disabled people from landmines and things like that. So there were two young brothers working there, and still today we've got two Australian brothers there in that very much developed place where I think it's something like 150 young people are being schooled or helped anyway in some ways in Cambodia. The leadership now is with the local people, but the Australian brothers still work there. Likewise, in Timor-Leste, to our north, there's been a growing Marist involvement in response to the request of the Bishop of Baucau. And a teachers' college has been set up there in association with Australian Catholic University, and there have been several graduation classes of local teachers. And they've also building a Marist school there, which is nearly ready. Some young Timorese have actually joined the brothers. So you can see several Australian brothers at the back, and some of those are novices. They're probably all novices, I think, or postulants who have applied to join. Now, backing up all of this has been a fundraising office in Britain called Australian Marist Solidarity. So it's registered as a not-for-profit company, and it's able to get tax-deductible donations for projects such as this in accord with AusAid guidelines. And so its main project work has been East Timor and also that project in Cambodia. But it's also supported projects, Marist projects in Myanmar, Fiji and Samoa. And often groups from Australian Marist schools would go across to these projects and have, you know, a couple of weeks of immersion involved with what's going on. That's five aspects. I think this last sixth development is probably the overarching one, and this is called the Marist Association of St. Marcellin Champagne. It's crucial for maintaining a Marist ethos in schools and other ministries. We've mentioned that much of Marist ministry since the 1980s has come to depend on lay colleagues who are committed to maintaining the values and the ethos and the charism inherited from St. Marcellin Champagne and the early Morris brothers. But the question is, how is that going to last? How permanent will it be? Is a lay principal and a lay staff at a school, say Parramatta Marist High for instance, able to or willing to continue the Marist ethos? Did they see themselves as Marist at heart? Is there a lay Marist vocation? A nucleus of Marist supporters actually came to think this way. Most of them were very active already in Marist schools or welfare. And around about 2011, this group, including some brothers, supported the creation of this Marist Association of St. Marcellin's Champagne. And they invited brothers and lay colleagues to become members. The uptake was quite strong. And on the website, this is its self-description now. It's probably a little bit dated, but that's probably a couple of years back it was written. This is what they say about themselves. The Marist Association of St. Marcellin Champagne is a vital faith community and expression of church that embraces God's mission with Marian joy, hope and audacity. We are a membership base of over 800, including Marist brothers, lay women and men, and clergy. We draw on both the Marist tradition of St. Marcellin Champagne and imagination to be game changers for young people, particularly those most on the peripheries. We foster connectedness and communion among ourselves as an association with the Marist spiritual family around the world and with the wider church. End of quote. Now, the association has an elected council. It has local groups who meet regularly. They've had national assemblies 2015, 2018, and this year, 2022. Since the association was to share responsibility for continuing the Marist mission in Australia, the brothers have sought to have it to get official recognition from the Vatican and from the Australian government. By 2021, the Marist Association was incorporated by the Australian government as a limited, not-for-profit company. So it is recognised in civil law, but not yet in Rome, not in canon law. So I've talked about six aspects of transformation. And there's a broadening, I think, of the Marist Brothers' mission through lay involvement and lay acceptance of responsibility. We could argue, I think, that now there is a broader reach than there ever was. New structures and a new bureaucracy have necessarily followed, and I would really stress the importance of this Marist Association for the future, because it will have governmental responsibility with the brothers through its leadership. But I think its main potential is as a spiritual association, helping to unite its now 900 or so members. That's the first council of the association. Three of those are brothers, the rest are lay. And that's an attempt to sort of say what's going on. You've got the original Marist Brothers Institute, but it's now sharing, if you like, with this much broader Marist Association. Some brothers are a part of it. And we would now talk about an Australian Marist community identifying as Marists, and that's who they are. Briefly to finish, what about the brothers? Where did all this leave them? Now, for some of them, the challenges and changes were difficult to accept. Most brothers adapted well, and they found opportunities for ministry often well suited to their individual characters. Many were happy to continue teaching or leading schools, but by 2000, the year 2000, we could find brothers as university lecturers, youth ministers, spiritual directors, prison chaplains, leaders of solidarity offices, some in the missions, Melanesia, Timor-Leste, Cambodia, the Philippines. So for the Morris Brothers of the schools, school is now a different, broader meaning. Many have joined the Morris Association because they see it as important for the continuation of the ministry. There's less need now for two provinces in Australia. So in 2012, the provinces of Sydney and Melbourne were amalgamated to become again the province of Australia, just the one provincial in Sydney. Now, even that's short-lived, because in the Pacific area, the islands and also New Zealand are having difficulty in getting local leaders and formators. So the superiors in Rome decided it would be best to bring together the communities and resources of the whole Oceania area again into one province. And so it's scheduled that the second province of Australia, starting in 2012, is scheduled to end this year on December the 8th, the Feast of the Immaculate Conception. And there'll be a new province, if you like, an amalgamated province called Star of the Sea. So we got a full circle from 1872, when John DeLay came out as provincial of Oceania. We're now going back to Oceania with the new province of Star of the Sea. So there'll be communities in Australia, New Zealand, Tonga, Samoa, Vanuatu, New Caledonia, Solomons, Papua New Guinea, Cambodia still, one province. Now, just going a bit broader, the Morris Brothers in Australia are just one of many congregations which have developed in Australia since the 1850s. I think other congregations would see reflections of their own history in what I've been talking about. And I think all of our congregations have been shaped by the broader historical influences that have affected Australia and the Catholic Church since the 1850s. Our book, again, The Recent History, has this as a concluding paragraph. A future history will tell of Champagne-Marists, lay and brothers, in Australia, Papua New Guinea, Solomon Islands, Vanuatu, New Caledonia, Aotearoa, New Zealand, Fiji, Samoa, Kiribati, Timor-Leste, and Cambodia. Star of the Sea is an early title for Mary, Mother of Jesus. Under this title, Mary was invoked to be protector and guide of seafarers. It is an apt title for communities of Marists connected by kilometres of ocean. In addition, it echoes the name of the sailing ship that in 1872 brought the founding community of brothers to Australia. It was called the Star of Peace. Thank you.
Dr. John Carmody moderated the Q&A.
Thanks very much, John. That was both informative and insightful with its reflections of past and future. In that sense, it fits into the remit of the Society very well. And I should have acknowledged at the beginning when I introduced you that John would be known to several of you as a former president of this Society, a teacher of history, PhD graduate and the author of a very insightful and informative book about Norman Gilroy, Biography of Norman Gilroy, which I hope is still available, because it's a very important book about Australian history. So thank you very much. And that insight is reflected in what we've heard today. So I'm sure there are some questions or comments from people who are present. Jeff. I might add that Jeff Hogan is alumnus of the Marists.
Thank you, John, for your very comprehensive coverage. I found it most interesting. Two points. When I was at St. Pat's at Churchill, just across the road, two of my teachers there, two brothers, one brother, Irvin, later Peter McDonough, he had been in the Solomons for many, many years, and in fact there was an issue during World War II, which I won't go into. And also one of my brothers, one of the teachers who taught me, Brother Donald, now John Mann, actually went to the Solomons after he taught at St. Pat's and was there for many years. So there was a long connection between the Australian Marists and the Pacific Islands. All right. The other thing you'd mentioned is the Royal Commission that had a bit of an impact. It's probably a little bit off topic, but I just mentioned that the state schools hardly got a mention in that Royal Commission. And the reason for that is that we were dealt with in the Police Royal Commission in the early 1990s. And I've got to say that Deirdre Grusselin, who was here, is basically responsible for having the terms of reference of that Royal Commission varied to look at child protection issues in government schools. Ken Boston, who was the Director General, appeared before that Royal Commission, had a very rough time at it, and within a month of coming back from it, and I was a principal of high school at the time, issued very strict protocols as that we were to follow. So from early 1990s, state schools were following absolutely strict protocols. And I give Deirdre acknowledgement for that.
Jeff, thanks for that. It certainly broadens the topic, and that's a huge area to talk about. But I appreciate your linking up with the earlier connection with the Solomons. Mainly, and that was, as you say, it was a tragic time. There were three brothers killed by the Japanese there. Yeah.
John, thanks very much for your address, both the text and the wonderful pictures. So we appreciate all the labour that went into that. I've got two questions, if I may. The first one, given that the brothers came out here in 1872, did that dating have anything to do with the Franco-Prussian War and the Paris Commune and the turmoil associated with that? And the second question is, as someone who was at a Christian Brothers school rather than Marist Brothers, I don't know much about the prayer, sub tuum presidium. I understand originally it was a Greek version, but I wonder if you could tell us, for my benefit and perhaps for a few others, what its role and history is and how much that's a part of Marist spirituality. Thank you.
Thanks, Robert. First point about whether the Franco-Prussian War and what else? The Paris Commune was relevant. My understanding is no. I think the Marist brothers were already coming to Oceania as assistants to the Marist Fathers, and it was really the Australian initiative that, in fact, there were calls to go all over the world, really, you know, and it was the Australian initiative that, and I think the fact that Archbishop Poling wrote the final request, Mac and Crowe got him to write the request that brought it out, but I think the there were plenty of requests to go to different parts of the world. I don't think it was affected so much by what was happening politically in France there. Yeah. Although it may have had some effect, yeah, I don't know. Sub tuum presidium, My understanding is that it was very early prayer, in Latin at least, in the... Well, look, I'm not sure what language it was originally, but I understood it was Latin about 300, that they have references to it. Just means, begins with, we fly to your patronage, is what the normal translation is, or we fly to your protection, Holy Mother of God. I think it's only in the last 30 or 40 years that somehow or other, with this whole sense of trying to cultivate a Marist sort of ethos and identity in the schools, that, and perhaps with modern communications being much more instant, that you're getting this sort of traditions built up, and it has become something like a, you know, like, if you like, the Hail Mary is a Catholic prayer in general, but for a Marist school, Sub Tuum Praesidium is probably said more than the Hail Mary. I don't know why, but it's become something like this. It's also sung at ceremonies, and generally Year 12 students have sung it at their Year 12 formals and finals, you know, final masses and things like that, so that eventually when they have their reunions in pubs and all that sort of thing, often they will break out into Sub Tuum Praesidium, you know. So it's become a, you know, just a culture thing.
Margaret.
Thank you, John, for a very informative talk. Could you say a bit more about the Marist charism? I mean, how would a child, a boy, in a Marist school be affected by that in a way which would be different to have been at a state school or a Christian Brothers school, for instance?
I think two things about it. A charism is a sort of ethos, if you like, a sense of direction or attitudes, perhaps emphases that are typical or characteristic, okay? Now, when I was at school, there was no such word. We didn't sing or know Sub Tuum Praesidium in Latin. We might have said, we said the Hail Mary a lot more than we said, we fly to your patronage, you know. I don't think we had this sort of, it was more just the fact that there were statues of Mary, there was an altar of Mary and all that sort of thing that typified a Marist school, and the brothers were the only teachers. But nowadays, I think there's a sort of conscious attempt to give, if you like, a fairly characteristic set of markers, if you like, of being in a Marist school. And they talk about five pillars of Marist education, and don't ask me to remember them, but I'm living at in the precincts of St Gregory's College at Campbelltown, and there's a walkway between the senior school and the junior school, and along the walkway there are paintings and quotations and saying this represents the first pillar of Marist education, and it might be love of work, or it might be love of Mary, or I can't remember all the others now, you know, but there's a sort of fairly uniform set of ideas or spirituality which brothers and administrators, leaders in the schools, attempt to inculcate in ceremonies, in the architecture. There'll be maps on the wall of where all the missions are, things like, or on in the schoolyard. The Sub Tuum will be sung at every major event. It's that type of thing, and it's. I think someone who's been to a Marist school in the last 20 years would know what I mean. Just a quick attempt.
Thank you very much for a delightfully enlightening address. There were a couple of things. You mentioned the devastating effect the findings of the Royal Commission had. What examination followed within the Marist community to address and reform put in place some reforms to address this, what they saw as a serious problem of needing readdress. The second part, or a separate part, is a growing funding, public funding, and the involvement of laity. How will that affect the future? I mean, there might have been some concerns when the findings of the Church Royal Commission appeared. Did that have any effect in the people leaving those Mara schools?
Okay, the first point, what was done within the Mara's congregation to address the findings. Well, there's been huge soul searching, and I don't say investigation because that was done externally, really, but reflection and very practical steps to try and address the findings. Now, a lot of that really, should have happened earlier, but things like protocols have been set up, very strict guidelines about who can do what, and very strict instructions and advice, all with the attempt of preventing any further such abuse. I think a lot of it occurs within leadership in setting up the guidelines and things like that, but then with all the brothers, there's a fair amount of information gets sent out to say, this is our advice, etc. And I think it's at least once a year, or maybe twice, earlier on it was twice a year for the last 10 years anyway, there's been a gathering of brothers, all the brothers, they're mandated to come to it in different capitals, at which topics of abuse and prevention and that, and there might be external speakers, all that sort of thing brought in, could be of various sorts. So that's been an annual event, that's continuing. There's one set of seminars coming up the next 2 months in Sydney. So that's one thing. There are very strict sanctions on brothers who have offended. They're no longer allowed to be in a school precinct. Even if it's not a proven allegation, sometimes that's one of the very difficult parts. Sometimes it doesn't actually go to court, but there's an allegation and no one knows whether it's right or wrong, and that person is actually removed from any contact with children. So it's been a huge effort, that's some of it, I think, apart from all the work that goes into it. There are brothers who have spent years in meeting victims and in meeting the families of them and working out redress protocols and things like that. So it's been a real traumatic period, really. Now, your second question was about whether in all of that, I think you were asking, did this cause enrolments to decline? Is that what you're getting at?
Yes.
Well, I'm sure that some people would have left the church if they were victims, or they certainly would not want to become associated with the Morris brothers if they were victims or their families were involved. Well, yes, I would think that. I don't think it has affected the Catholic schools as a group. I think their numbers are pretty stable, and they're actually, in some areas, they're growing, I think.
Thank you, John. You referred to St Vincent's at Westmead, and I think you mentioned the word, I might be wrong in this, you said 500, you used the words, I thought you said 500, was there ever 500 students at Westmead?
No, I said 500 for the new Marist 180. There were five. This is current, right? Now, Westmead no longer exists, right? But the welfare project has morphed into this broad organisation called Marist 180. And it has about 500 lay staff working for it. That's the 500 that I recall mentioning.
Thank you for clearing that up. Thank you.
John, could I ask something which is a bit more parochial in a way? And it may have something to do with the individual nature of the states of Australia or the diocese. But in the earlier version of this map that you put up, there were a lot of there were places in Victoria, there were a lot of places in Sydney, a lot of places in New Zealand, but by 1918 or thereabouts, nothing yet in Queensland. And yet there are two Marist major schools until Rosalie was closed. Is there any reason why the move to the north didn't occur, or didn't occur until much later?
Okay. Good. So the first school in Queensland was in Brisbane at Rosalie, which was, I think, 1928. And then Marist Ashgrove followed, and then there have been several schools after that. Cairns. There was one in Cairns in 1930. Now, well, Queensland, I suppose, in the Brisbane area, the Archbishop of Brisbane, Dunn before him, yeah. From what I understand, he basically always got Christian Brothers to start schools there, and they had quite a number in the early 20th century. Now, when Dewey came in, he apparently was keen on getting Marist schools, but he'd asked first round about 1920, I think, to get brothers to come up there, but the brothers at that stage couldn't afford, they didn't have the men to go there, and it wasn't until 1928 that they got brothers in Queensland. So I think it was partly Archbishop Dunn to begin with, but then lack of available brothers to go until 1928.
Thanks, John. I had something of that in mind when I mentioned when the Marists came to Australia. It was a very Irish-dominated church, yeah. And Queensland certainly was like that with the Marist brothers and the Christian brothers, rather. And I can remember that ourselves were almost underrepresented. It was only in my lifetime, in the 1950s or 1960s, that the Augustinians came. It was very much an Irish Christian Brothers enclave, that's right.
A bit more on Sub Tuum Presidium. My recent researchers turned up the fact that it is, in fact, the oldest Catholic Marian hymn, the oldest. If you go looking for recordings of it, you'll find plenty of plainsong recordings. If you go looking for the one that's used in Australian Marist schools, it's very hard to find a good recording, but I found one really loudly bawled version by a large secondary group of schoolboys. And I can only imagine that if the old boys got together and performed it, it would be even more roisterous. Now, the version that we sing in Australia is by a French composer of the 19th century whose surname was Lambilotte. I first encountered it at a Marist school. I was 7 years in a Marist school from the late 50s to almost the mid-60s. Yes, I knew the words of the chorus. Now, I was a boy who sang an awful lot of liturgical Latin at that age, and the funny thing is, I can't remember the words of the verses. Now, go on several decades, and I go to a barbecue in Gladesville Parish, where they've just welcomed a whole lot of interstate and international youth, and it's in World Youth Day Week. And there's a group of young people there from a Melbourne Marist school, and they stood up on the top of a stairwell and sang
sub tuum with both verses, not just the first verse, but both verses. And I was rather struck that all these years after we'd adopted English in the liturgy, that a piece of Latin was still being sung. In my parish, about 15 years ago, we had a funeral of a man who had taught all his teaching life in Marist schools, and before that he was educated in Marist schools. And there was a terrific turn-up of former Marist students and teachers, and one of the things that he required to be sung was Sub Tuum Presidium. So it has great currency.
Thanks, John. I don't know the second verse, and in terms of the students, I very much doubt if they know what the meanings are. They've probably been told it. It's just a cultural thing for them, I think. And I mean, it's respected, but it's cultural. Brother Kelvin Canavan is here. I think you mentioned you had a question for me once, Kelvin.
We've often talked about keeping the history alive. Well, one of the things that's happened since COVID, a group of people have got together in the Catholic sector to pull together the story of Catholic education. They've done many, many interviews, and really getting the history together. And Australian Catholic University recently took this under its wing, and so now there's a group in Australian Catholic University responsible for pulling the story of Catholic education in Australia together.
That group is now replicating, if you like, the Dictionary of Australian Biography. They now have a dictionary of biographical dictionary of Australian Catholic educators. So lots of the sort of leading educators, Catholic identities and that, are now online in this website, which is the dictionary, and you can search it, and it's only just become available this year, and it's an ongoing thing, so that as people write new biographies, and I've been asked to write one on Monica Turner, who was ran Sydney Catholic Parents and Friends Association as secretary in the state aid battles of the 1960s and 70s. So that's the sort of person.
We might conclude with an observation. This discussion about anthems has reminded me that another aspect of Margaret's question about the ethos of the education. I don't remember, as an alumnus of two Christian Brothers schools, I don't remember any overarching Christian Brothers. Each school had its own school song, and don't tempt me with my voice, my ageing voice, to give you a reversion of it, but it was set to the tune of Men of Harlech. And we sang that at every opportunity, but there was never a Christian Brothers overarching anthem or hymn or song that I can remember. Perhaps that's an important point of cultural difference, the French influence, perhaps we should draw matters to a close with that. Those of you who remember John from his days as president, those of you who've read the book on Cardinal Gilroy, will realise what a fine historian he is from today. He's also a member of a very distinguished family. He's the nephew of Cyril Walsh, who was, in some ways, many people in the law would regard him as Australia's greatest jurist. He was a distinguished member of the New South Wales Supreme Court, and when he moved to the High Court of Australia, death struck fairly soon after that. If he hadn't died so young, he'd have been remembered. But John is also a very distinguished scholar in his own right, and it was a great honour to have him here today. Thank you very much, John.
We've been listening to Dr. John Luttrell, a Marist brother, speaking about Champagne Marists in Australia, 1872 to 2022. The Q&A which followed was moderated by Dr. John Carmody, President of the Australian Catholic Historical Society. It took place on Sunday, the 18th of September, in the crypt of the Parish Church of St. Patrick, Churchill, Sydney, Australia.
Dr. Luttrell is a co-author of Sub Tuum Praesidium, Maris Brothers in Australia, 1872-2022, a work of 576 pages, published in June by Maris Brothers Australia. I should add that Brother Kelvin Canavan mentioned during the meeting that the hymn, Sub Tuum, is still sung after certain St. Joseph's College rugby union matches. And a former Sacred Heart seminarian told me over coffee after the meeting that he had sung Sub Tuum in seminary, hardly surprising, as the missionaries of the Sacred Heart, like the Marists, were founded in France. ACHS podcasts are produced by me, John Kenny, and made on the traditional lands of the Gadigal and Wattamedigal peoples of the Eora Nation. The Society acknowledges the prior ownership, never ceded, of all parts of Australia by its Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. Our next history talk will take place on the afternoon of Sunday, the 16th of October 2022, when Professor John Potts, Department of Media, Communications, Creative Arts, Language and Literature, Macquarie University, will discuss religion on ABC Radio from the 1940s to the present. We hope that you can join us for that talk. Bye for now.